Hello and welcome to Alita Diamond Shades of Murder, a podcast where I will share and discuss tales of true crime, mysteries, and all things dark and macabre. If you eat, play, and dream in Shades of Murder like me, then welcome, my kindred spirits, to your new podcast home. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to follow, share, and subscribe so I can present more stories to you, and we can all embrace the allure of the darkness together. All of my social media and contact information you can find in the episode description below. This is a special warning to anyone who is offended or highly sensitive to discussions that involve the mutilation of people and animals. This case is highly disturbing and contains very graphic details of a sexual and violent nature. There are some cases of murder that may be too revolting to share. Some stories stay with you and leak inside your mind at the darkest and quietest of hours. Tales of terror that can mirror the most grotesque and perverse of horror films, which may be too close for comfort to exist in the real world. I am not into shock value within the true crime community. I would never share and discuss a case or story of a murder that I find to be disrespectful to the victims, make light of an offender's crimes, or present them as mere entertainment. However, there are some cases that are fascinating to me because they are so disturbing and bizarre. There are some murders that I cannot help but want to peek a little closer at and learn more about the story of the kind of human being who is so depraved, twisted, and, well, in the most simple terms, evil. And what could have possibly triggered or inspired their behavior. This is the case of aspiring serial killer, Jason Eric Massey. In Tellico, Texas, on a hot, sticky summer morning on July 29, 1993, two bodies would be found by members of a work crew who were horrified by what they discovered. Off the side of what was referred to as Cut Off Road, which is where the small towns of Tellico and Enos were linked by a rickety wooden bridge across Smith Creek, two workers noticed something strange. Within the thick, lush area of trees and bushes, which they realized upon closer inspection, was a decapitated, nude body of what appeared to be a young girl. They immediately ran to call the police, who promptly arrived at the scene. The victim had been shot and stabbed. Her head was missing, and her hands had been lopped off at the wrists. She also had excessive amounts of wounds across her abdomen, thighs, and genital area, and her nipples had been amputated. The carvings made into the girl's flesh were described as long and intricate, done in an almost delicate manner. It was obvious from the horrific scene that a great amount of time and energy had been placed into the mutilation and dismemberment of the young girl's corpse. Within 200 feet of the female victim's remains laid underneath the bridge, the body of a young male. The crime scene was in stark contrast to the previous site, as his body was treated in a completely opposite manner. The act appeared to be quick and rash, with no thought or concern as to how the body would be revealed. The boy was fully clothed and had two gunshots in his head, which appeared to be made from a small caliber pistol. In the back pocket of the boy's jeans, investigators found a library card with the name James Brian King. When investigators visited the home of their suspected male victim, James Brian King, his father confirmed that the wallet was his son's, and that the girl victim could potentially be his stepdaughter, Christina Benjamin, who was only 13 years old. The following is an account in which Mr. King told the police about what he recalled from the night before his kids went missing. In the hours between midnight and 1 o'clock, Mr. King awoke to witness a vehicle suddenly pulling into the driveway. The person honked the horn twice, and then drove away. A little time passed, and then the same vehicle returned. This time, the driver turned off the headlights and parked the car. He watched as his son, James, who had been sleeping outside on the hammock as it had been a hot and humid summer night, began chatting with someone inside the tan-colored vehicle. At this point, Mr. King decided that since he was already up, he would use the restroom. Upon returning, he noticed that both the vehicle and his 14-year-old son were gone. He waited a while, an hour or so, thinking surely James would return soon. But when he did not, he just went back to bed. When Mr. King woke up the next morning, he found that neither his son James nor his stepdaughter Christina were inside the house. When he awoke his wife, Donna Benjamin, to tell her that their kids were missing, although concerned, they decided to not panic right away and gave them some time to return on their own. When they failed to show up later on in the day, they decided to go searching for them. They couldn't find them at their friends' or their usual hangout spots, so they went to the police that same day and filed a missing persons report. There was no sign of either James or Christina, nor any idea as to where they had gone. When their children's bodies were found 2 days later, a nightmarish scene of what their last moments held would unfold. The female adolescent was significantly more challenging to identify than the male victim. The usual methods of identification through fingerprints and dental records had been eliminated, since both her hands and her head had been removed and were nowhere to be found. She had a long cut all the way down her abdomen and to the side of it, where parts of her intestines had been extruded. At the crime scene, near the location of the female's body, was a barbed wire fence. Intertwined within the wire, detectives would discover a handful of long blonde hairs. Using Christina's hairbrush, the crime lab tested and analyzed the blonde hair strands located at the crime scene and compared them to Christina's. It was determined that they were microscopically similar. Her parents informed the police that she had a recent injury to one of her feet, and when they compared the x-ray to the autopsy results, they matched. The young female victim had been successfully identified. In the crime lab, the senior analyst Charles A. Lynch discovered a blonde hair on James' body that did not match either of the victims, in addition to a solo fiber that had attached itself to one of the boy's shoes. The analyst suggested that it may be from a tan vehicle manufactured in Japan, since it was unique and its use had been limited to certain types of Japanese models. The forensic pathologist, Sheila Spotswood, shared with Forensic Files how it was by far the worst case of mutilation to a body that she had ever been exposed to in her career. A psychological profile of the perpetrator would be created by criminal profilers. It was suggested that the extreme brutality and grisly butchering of the victim's body were indicative of someone who wanted vengeance and had a lot of rage pent up towards their victim. This further suggested that the murderer most likely knew the victim. A rape test was later performed on the victim, but there were no signs of sexual assault. When investigators consulted the Human Behavioral Unit of the FBI at Quantico, the police were informed that this killing was not sexually motivated. The Human Behavioral Unit noted how there was one trait shared across similar modus operandi of perpetrators, which is that there was always a history of animal abuse. As most of us true crime listeners are already aware, causing intentional harm to animals is a strong indicator of future violence towards humans and is commonly known as a shared characteristic of serial killers. Neighbors would inform the investigators that both James and Christina had planned on hanging out with an older guy named Jason on the night they went missing. An anonymous caller then contacted the police department to let them know that they should be looking for a young man named Jason Massey. A 20-year-old high school dropout, Jason was the son of an alcoholic and drug abuser who moved from one run-down, dilapidated residence to another. Jason was a known petty thief to the local police, who also had a criminal history of stalking, harassment, theft, and animal abuse. A few days prior to the murders, there had been a call to the police about a cat that had been butchered and tossed behind at the McDonald's in town. When the officers arrived at the scene, they found a tan vehicle abandoned and a bracelet that had been dropped to the ground with the name Jason engraved. This individual had fled from the scene, but was later identified to be Jason Eric Massey. His friends would reveal to the investigators that Jason frequently murdered and mutilated animals, in particular cats, dogs, and cows. He was known to capture and kill cats and dogs as often as he could. Jason would decapitate them and keep their heads as trophies, which he stored inside a metal freezer. His friends, in later interviews, would also inform the police that Jason talked about Christina a lot. Jason told them that he was interested in her and wanted to take her out. Although this information was all very suspicious and disturbing regarding the deranged behavior of Jason Massey, everything was circumstantial up to this point in the investigation, since there was hardly any solid evidence collected at the crime scene. Then detectives heard a report by several people in town that Jason Massey had been seen carrying a gun around town. Since he was on probation, this was a blatant violation of the condition. So the police arrested him. The store clerk, who sold Jason the .22 caliber bullets for the pistol, in addition to two knives and a pair of handcuffs, identified him in a police lineup. Now that his picture was in the newspaper, someone else came forward to identify Jason Massey and their suspicions. Law enforcement received another anonymous phone call from someone who claimed to have seen Jason Massey at a local car wash the day after the murders, cleaning his vehicle inside and out. When the police arrived at the car wash, the owner claimed to have witnessed Jason Massey around 11:30 p.m. one night, not long after the murders had happened. He watched as Jason threw items away into the trash bin. When the investigators searched the contents of the trash bin and the vacuums at the car wash, they discovered a discarded card for an appointment with Jason's probation officer and a red bandana with several long blonde hairs attached. Once again, the hairs were found to be microscopically similar to those of Christina Benjamin's. Armed now with a search warrant for his home and his vehicle, homicide investigators would unearth strong circumstantial evidence. Inside Jason Massey's house, they discovered a pair of handcuffs and numerous news articles he had kept about the murders. The investigators still did not have much more than circumstantial evidence, but it was enough to garner a search warrant to collect a hair sample and search his tan Subaru. Inside his vehicle, they collected a piece of the carpet to test against the fiber which had been found on James Bryan's body. There were also three dark red stains on the car seat, which the crime lab would test positive for blood. Within the trunk of the vehicle lay a single leaf splattered with blood, a roll of duct tape with what appeared to have smear of blood on it, in addition to a hammer that seemingly had blood on it as well. There was no gun to be found, but they did find a Walmart receipt with items that strongly suggested he had been involved in the crime. The receipt included purchases for .22 caliber ammunition, a set of handcuffs, and a hunting knife. I wonder, what is it about Walmart that attracts so many violent perpetrators to pick up their kill kits there than in other places? We have seen this over and over through the years, and in very recent cases too. The majority of the time, the offender doesn't even attempt to conceal their identity and is stupid enough to use their debit or credit card to make the purchases for items. Items that clearly have been selected to aid in the execution of the crime. I mean, why would you go to one place and shop for all the products you may potentially need to kidnap, torture, and murder someone? That just seems really idiotic to me, or extremely arrogant to do this. And expect that there won't be a digital trace or even store security footage of the event? I just always find it shocking and almost laughable that perpetrators do this, but violent offenders don't seem to learn this lesson and continue to go there. Anyway, tangent time, and now back to our case. The DNA found in the bodies was not able to yield results of any accuracy since the remains were far too decomposed. Reverse paternal genotyping was utilized to determine the sources of the DNA. Simply explained, if there is DNA, such as blood, bone, or hair, that is from an unknown source, and the biological father is not available to be tested, then the DNA of the mother, another child, or sibling of the alleged father can be used in its place. These results then help determine if there are enough genetic markers that are shared. By analyzing the genes of both Christina and Brian's biological parents, which in this case was Brian's dad and Christina's mom, their DNA was used to compare to the blood found in Jason Massey's vehicle. Forensic scientists determined that they were similar genetic markers and that it was a high probability that the blood had come from Christina. Another critical component of the prosecutors being able to prove their case was that the victim's time of death aligned with the time that Jason Massey was known to have picked up the two adolescents the night of their disappearance. Forensic entomologist Dr. Neil Haskell revealed via the progression of the larva that both victims had been murdered 2 days before their bodies were discovered. With this compilation of evidence, Jason Massey was charged with capital murder. As communicated by the district attorney, either Jason Massey was the killer, or he was the unluckiest person in the world because every element of the crimes now pointed directly toward him. When investigators brought Jason Eric Massey in for questioning, the Maine police detective presented him with gruesome crime scene photos of young Christina's mutilated corpse. The homicide detective, in a pretty bold move, abruptly asked Jason, and I quote, "Tell me one thing, is she as pretty in these photos as she was the night you had her?" And he threw the photos down on the table in front of Jason. According to the detective, Jason looked down at the photos and then peered back up at him, and visibly gagged at the images in front of him. The investigator believed this to be a genuine reaction to what Jason had done to the victim, and a clear indicator that they had their perpetrator. In August 1994, Jason Eric Massey would stand trial for the brutal slayings of the two teenagers. During his trial, it was revealed by one of Jason's friends, Christopher Nolan, how Christina and Jason had mutually flirted with one another, and he had heard them talking about going out one night. It was illustrated by the prosecution that both Christina and her brother James Bryan had left their house around midnight with Jason Massey for what they believed to be a ride out in the country with him. As they rode along the cutoff bridge, Jason abruptly pulled over the car and shot James Bryan twice in the head. He pushed his body out of the vehicle and left him on the side of the bridge. Christina escaped from the vehicle at this time and fled for her life deep into the woods. As he ran after her, Jason shot Christina in the back, but she did not die from the bullet. A little while later, Jason shot her in the head and stabbed her with his hunting knife. Fortunately, for the sake of the victim and her loved ones, it was believed and portrayed by the prosecution that any mutilation of Christina's body was done post-mortem. Her head and hands were never found. One of the foundations of criminal trials is for the prosecution to have a transparent motive to base its case in order to illustrate to members of the jury what led to the occurrence of the crime. However, in this case, that was very challenging for the state to prove, since there was no clear and concise reason as to why these murders had happened. The most likely motivation behind Jason Eric Massey's vile, grotesque, and senseless crimes are explained by what criminal profilers have categorized to be as lust murders. Lust murderers are individuals who receive sexual gratification from the murder and mutilation of another person, or in Jason Massey's case, any living creature. While the trial was ongoing, a hunter discovered deep within the woods the darkest and most macabre of items, a metal cooler, where inside laid 31 heads of animals Jason had killed and decapitated. This item was exactly as Jason's friends had described to the police earlier in the investigation. What was even more disturbing than the cooler of creatures' heads were the journals that revealed the darkest and most depraved parts of Jason Eric Massey's mind. Labeled, quote-unquote, the Slayer's Books of Death. These journals chronicled the deaths of the animals he had murdered and the very descriptive and explicit plans he had laid out in his aspiration to become a serial killer. These journal entries exposed the sick and twisted mind of Jason Massey and his obsessive thoughts about murder, sex, and the mutilation of young girls. Prior to the jury being privy to the specifics of horror which these journals contained, they unanimously returned with a verdict of guilty of capital murder and the deaths of Christina and James Brine. The prosecution was given 24 hours from this stage to the penalty phase to compile together evidence from the journals to support their recommendation of the death penalty to the jury. There was a compiled list of animals Jason Massey had killed in the journals, including 8 cows, 30 dogs, and 39 cats. He wrote in his journal about how he had cut off their heads and kept them as his trophies, which was evidenced by the horrific scene found within the metal cooler. Jason also wrote about a young girl whom he expressed love for, but whom he wanted to kill. However, he recorded that he had not decided when he would. There were indisputable amounts of written evidence that Jason Massey's intentions were to murder as many people as possible, and that his ultimate goal in life was to become the most famous serial killer in America. He went even so far as to calculate how many people he would need to murder each month to reach the goal of 700 victims over the next 2 decades. The jury returned in a record-breaking 15 minutes with a recommendation to the judge of a sentence of death. The judge agreed and sentenced Jason Eric Massey to death by lethal injection. When he gave him the sentence, he told him, and I quote, "The only injustice in court today is that you will be given a much more humane death than what your victims received." The entire courthouse gave a standing ovation to the judge when he said these words. One of the more relevant and interesting of his 24 points of error Jason Massey later raised with the appellate court was his claim that the evidence presented in court should have been suppressed since it was collected by the information given to the police by Mark Gentry and Christopher Nolan. These two informants, Jason's sidekicks and fellow delinquent so-called friends, both had criminal backgrounds and could have prospectively been involved in the murders. However, this information was omitted from the search warrant's probable cause affidavit. The court disagreed with Jason's claim, since not only did the affidavit state that they were both of unscrupulous character, but that only a few days prior to the murders, all three were supposed to have met with the victims to hypothetically kill the kids. However, this plan fell apart when Gentry was stabbed in a fight which landed him in the hospital, and the other informant, Nolan, had passed out wasted. Detective Cruz, who was in charge of the information given to him by the informants, acknowledged that although there was a likelihood that all three could have been involved, there was no evidence to support this theory. Jason Massey also claimed that the material representation of the evidence in the court trial was in conflict with the statement made by the medical examiner. Christopher Nolan testified in court that Massey had told him that he wanted to, and I quote, "cut the girls' pussy lips off, fry them, and eat them." This was then backed up by the evidence of the female victim's head having been chopped off and mutilated, in addition to the removal of her hands, slashes on her body, and the cutting of the labial region on her body. However, the medical examiner specifically attested to the fact that the female's parts did not have any direct injuries. Jason Massey's attempt to dispute this evidence failed, since the medical examiner testified that there were several cuts on the front, to the side, and near the labia and pubic area, which the court deemed to be close enough evidence to support the witness's statement. Another claim Jason Massey attempted to prove was how the trial court had erred in allowing for the evidence that was obtained by the grand jury subpoena process to be submitted in court. Through a subpoena of his medical records, the prosecution unearthed a journal written by Jason Massey that had been copied into his files. This journal was an exact copy of one of the 4 journals that had been discovered in the woods inside his metal storage cooler of decapitated animal heads. The journals from the hospital to be submitted as evidence during the trial were objected to by Jason Massey's defense counsel, to which the judge agreed. However, since the same evidence was gathered prior to without their objection. The later request for objection on the journals is waived. I think this is a very strange and honestly kind of unsettling rule that the court establishes and reinforces. In this case, though, it was obviously very critical for the prosecution to present and read passages to the jury to clearly illustrate the mindset and motivations of the defendant, which helped to gauge future dangerousness and determine his punishment. During the trial, the prosecutor asked Jeff Estine and Ben Viers, other acquaintances of the accused, about the bizarre things Jason Massey would tell them he wanted to do to women. Jeff Estine shared with the court how Jason Massey would discuss at random, in the middle of everyone just hanging out, how he wanted to have sex with women, specifically that he wanted to kill them first and then have sex with their dead bodies. Jason Massey even openly discussed with these guys how he desired to cut off a woman's head and have sex with her where her head once was. Jason Massey attempted to claim that their testimony was irrelevant. I personally find this to be pretty laughable and truly ridiculous how he thought that claim would be bought by the appellate court. Could any conversations Jason Massey ever had with other people be considered more relevant than those which were offered by these two witnesses? This information identified the suspect, what drove him, and his appalling intentions after he committed the murders. Jason Massey also claimed that such testimony should have been inadmissible under Rule 403, which addresses testimony that is prejudicial. He stated that since he never spoke of any particular girl or woman when he shared his fantasies, they should not have been permitted as evidence. Again, that is asinine, since his specific modus operandi, which he shared with his friends, was the exact modus operandi that he implemented on his female victim. Why? These supposed friends and acquaintances of this budding, aspiring serial killer never reported such concerns is beyond my comprehension. They apparently never took Jason Massey's fantasies seriously, since he was always going on and on about killing girls and having sex with their corpses. Who were these guys that they just shrugged off his disgusting, perverse, and very strange desires? What kind of people continue to hang out with a person who openly discusses murdering, mutilating, and wanting to have sex with women after he kills them? I know that these other young men cannot and should not be held criminally liable for acts they did not initiate, encourage, or participate in. However, their own lack of a moral compass and complete absence of concern for Jason Massey's potential, even hypothetically speaking, future victims, is disturbing. They chose to spend time with a guy who talked about raping and decapitating girls and who were all perfectly aware of the countless slaughtered animals whose decapitated heads Jason kept in his cooler as trophies. What in their minds thought this was acceptable behavior and that they shouldn't at the very least stop hanging out with this guy? Was it because they all grew up together? It was a very small town and they thought, no, you know, Jason with his cooler of animal skulls and wanting to have sex with women's missing head holes. That's just our friend Jason. I mean, what the holy hell? Although he initially pleaded not guilty, 8 years later, at the time of his execution, Jason Eric Massey confessed to murdering Christina and James. Before he was put to death, Jason wrote a statement expressing to the families of his victims how he wished he could have known them all to give a proper apology to each one of them. He shared with the families that he was sorry for what he had taken from them. Jason Massey alleged that he alone was the cause of their deaths and that he wanted them to know that Christina was not in any pain when she died. Jason swore in his letter that he mutilated her body after she had died, did not sexually assault her, nor did he torture her while she was still breathing. He let her parents know that the rest of her body had been thrown into the Trinity River, so they would at least know where the remains lay. Jason also expressed to his own family how sorry he was for the pain he had caused them. He then told both of the families and the judge how, and I quote, God has used this to change my life. His last statement before he was given a lethal injection was, "Tonight I dance on the streets of gold. Let those without sin cast the first stone." On April 3rd, 2001, Jason Eric Massey was executed. He was pronounced officially dead at 6:20 p.m. It was noted how Jason Massey idolized infamous serial killers Ted Bundy and Henry Lee Lucas, the latter who he allegedly got to spend some time with while sitting on Texas's death row. While he was on death row, Jason Massey expressed in an interview with the Enos Daily News how people change, that he had changed, and that as he has grown, he has changed, and can recognize all of the dumb mistakes he made in his life. Apparently, Jason Eric Massey had found religion while in prison and saw the error and darkness of his ways. I'm sorry, but I don't believe for one second that someone who aspired more than anything in the world to be the most prolific serial killer in American history was changed by God, or whatever or whoever he wants to claim it was that made him grow up and change. His behavior and his crimes went way beyond growing out of some rebellious delinquent stage or having an infatuation with serial killers. Jason Massey talked about ad nauseum with his friends about his sick, perverted desires towards girls. He wrote explicit details in his journals about the animals he had murdered and decapitated for fun, and plotted out a plan about how he would achieve his goal of killing upwards of 700 people over the next two decades. He was not a career criminal, simply involved in drug dealing or robberies, who realized the harm they had caused by the introduction of religion or other positive sources in their life. This was a young man who slaughtered endless animals for pleasure and who was a self-professed aspiring serial killer. As aforementioned, the FBI Human Behavioral Unit, which had helped assist in the investigation of the murders of Christina and James Bryan, had pointed out that the modus operandi was reflective of a Lest killer. So let us discuss what a Lest murderer profile is, and what could be the potential warning signs of such an offender. In the research article, Body Dismemberment in Sexual Homicide Cases, Lest Murder or Rational Decision, scholars Julian Chopin and Eric Beauregard discuss the motivations behind sexual homicide offenders and their correlation to cases of body dismemberment. There are differences between criminal dismemberment versus mutilation, which signals the difference between the motivations and intentions of the offender. First, the dismemberment of a body can of course result from numerous circumstances, including an accident, suicide, or homicide. Criminal dismemberment is distinctly different from mutilation, which is the removal or irreparable disfigurement of a smaller section of a larger area of the body. This can include the removal of the testes, or what is known as castration, evisceration, which is the removal of the internal organs, flaying, also known as skinning, which is the removal of the skin, or a combination of these acts. Criminal dismemberment, on the other hand, is the entire removal of a significant portion of a person's body, whether they are living or dead, during the commission of murder. Specifically, this encompasses decapitation, which is the removal of the head, and the removal of the hands, arms, torso, legs, feet, or pelvic area. There are two categories of criminal dismemberment, defensive and offensive. Defensive criminal dismemberment of a body usually refers to a body being dismembered with the primary purpose of the act being disposal or concealment. Offensive criminal dismemberment is directly linked to the reception of sexual gratification from the act of dismembering itself. In studies conducted on offensive versus defensive motivation, it was found that approximately 60% of offenders were driven to dismember the victim's body out of the desire to conceal or dispose of the body, with the sole aim to prevent its discovery and thus prolong the investigation. For those offenders who engaged in offensive dismemberment, the act was often a sign of their sexual deviance and even the presence of paraphilia. Paraphilia is the presence of intense and incessant sexual interest in having sexual contact with someone or something outside of what our society deems to be a mature and normal individual who is able to consent to the act. Someone who has been diagnosed with a paraphiliac disorder is defined as when that specific sexual interest causes the individual great stress and leads the person to be impaired to the extent that gratification of this interest involves harm to themselves or the threat of harm to others. For such an offender, the act of dismemberment can be the primary or secondary act of the person's sexual deviance. When dismemberment is the central or primary act, sexual gratification is achieved by the penetration of the body, whether it is through cutting, biting, or stabbing, and is commonly linked to the profile of the lust murderer. When dismemberment is the secondary act, this is often connected to erotophonophilia, which is when sexual gratification is gained by the act of murder itself. This is often associated with offenders who dissect, eviscerate the body, and/or remove the breasts or other limbs of their victim. It can also be associated with necrophilia, which is sexual gratification resulting from sexual acts performed with the corpse or just parts of the body. In an analysis conducted on the process of the commission of the crime, it was found that sexual homicide offenders who dismembered their victims were very likely to have an organized modus operandi, which is consistent with the finding on lust murderers. The murders were characterized by premeditation and the opportunity to a vulnerable target they were given. It was also revealed that the location of the crime was specifically selected so as to minimize distraction or disruptions to the process. The profiles of an organized murder often include a criminal history, contextual strains such as job, money, or relationship stressors, and the collection of trophies taken in association with the crime. Interesting how Jason Massey fits this profile so perfectly with his lack of a job, money, lack of a positive or supportive relationship, and a long criminal history, in addition to his ever-growing collection of animal heads. Studies across various countries have unearthed that criminal dismemberment occurs somewhere between 5 and 20% of cases, which is an abnormally large margin. To me, this is indicative of very little research having been conducted on the issue and the parameters of what defines it. Victims of criminal dismemberment are predominantly female between the ages of 20 and 59 years old. However, when criminal dismemberment has been committed in connection with sexual homicide, males represented a higher portion than females, in particular adolescent males. Research also showed that as high as 16% of adult victims were involved in sex work, similar to so many relationships between victim and offender, especially in violent crimes. The majority were acquaintances, shared a close social circle, and around 9% had a personal intimate relationship. In a study of 100 cases of sexual homicide, torture was inflicted postmortem in 31%. Necrophilia occurred in roughly 15%, and in most cases of criminal dismemberment, the act took place at the same location as the murder. A criminal profile is established around specific elements and distinct traits around a crime, which demonstrates certain personality factors of the perpetrator. For lust murderers, these patterns can be revealed by the condition of the victim's body, including the cause of death, the weapon or tool used to inflict the death or damage done to the body, any mutilation or removal of the remains, in addition to the way the body is positioned. Now, unless the profiler is the first one at a crime scene, which is almost always impossible, the process can be complicated. In order to help better understand the motivations and characteristics of the perpetrator, with the goal of capturing the offender and preventing similar crimes, a criminal profiler must create the most accurate profile possible. This usually involves the analysis of all reports regarding the investigation, including autopsy results from the forensic pathologist, as many detailed pictures as possible of the victim's body and the crime scene itself, as well as its surrounding vicinity. It may also encompass details about the victim, including the location they were last known to be seen or heard from, in relation to the location of their body, and any information regarding their interests and activities. In an article written by two FBI special agents under the Behavioral Science Unit, Robert R. Hazelwood and Johnny Douglas, the profile and motivations of a Lust murderer are described. What makes a Lust murderer unique from other forms of sadistic homicide offenders is the focused assault on the breasts or private area of their victims. Whether they are mutilated or removed altogether can vary depending on the individual. But their being a primary target of the violence is what distinguishes them from other kinds of murderers. The Behavioral Science Unit agents Hazelwood and Douglas further define sub-profiles of the Lust murderer and break them down into two predominant types. The first is the organized non-social, and the second is the disorganized antisocial personality. An organized non-social Lust murderer tends to present a lack of investment in the well-being or concerns of society, and with it often expresses an attitude that lacks any responsibility or genuine feelings for others. These are the manipulators and narcissistic Lust murderers. These are the types of predators who, although they hate people, hide their disgust or lack of empathy for humans under the guise of being likable and personable. Their personality is highly methodical and calculating, and their end goal is to adversely impact society, which is the dominant purpose of why they commit their heinous crimes. Typically, this kind of murderer does not live in close proximity to the crime scene and tends to search for and hunt their victims. What excites them is the cruelty that they or others can inflict upon other living things, in particular other humans. Whether this is in form of entertainment they enjoy engaging in, or in their real life. In contrast, there is the disorganized, asocial Lust murderer who resides on the outskirts of normal society. This kind of person avoids social interaction, does not tend to be manipulative because people are not their strong point, and in fact tends to be a loner, rejected by others in their personal life, and on the whole by society. Such types of killings will exhibit these personality characteristics through the frenzied manner in which the murders take place, and often are in close vicinity to where the person lives and or works. This is because this type of individual does not feel confident or secure venturing outside of what is deemed to be their normal path and routine. The Lust killing is a premeditated crime in the minds of each of these types, but most of the time, for the disorganized asocial Lust murderer, the act itself is more spontaneous, a spur-of-the-moment affair where the dark fantasies of the offender manifest themselves into reality. For the disorganized asocial type, the body of their victim will be commonly left in an area that is not frequently trafficked by others, but there are also no efforts made to conceal the corpse. For the organized, non-social Lust murderer, the individual commits the murder in an area that is more desolate, and then they will often transport the body to a different area for it to be discovered. The non-social type tends to gain extra stimulation in the body being found, and is excited by the adverse effects its discovery makes on the community. Studies on the demographics of such murders have shown that the victim can be either male or female. The crime is mainly heterosexual in its manner and is almost always intraracial, which means that the victim and the perpetrator are of the same racial makeup. The body of the victim is brutally mutilated, with the breasts, genitals, and rectum often slashed, maimed, or stabbed with some kind of sharp weapon or tool to the point of excess. The destruction of the body is traditionally conducted after the victim has died, and the victim usually is killed quickly following the initial assault or abduction. When there are signs of mutilation or torture having occurred prior to the victim's death, this is indicative of the organized, non-social type rather than the asocial. Regarding instruments of murder, guns are highly unusual for a Lust murderer to utilize, since they are too impersonal to satisfy any sexual gratification. Strangulation, blunt force trauma, or the use of a sharp pointed weapon or tool are the most common methods of death. Whereas the asocial type has been known to use a weapon of access meaning whatever they can get their hands on a whim to cause the person's death, and even will leave it behind at the crime scene, the antisocial is prone to carrying the weapon on their person and leaves the scene with it. Amputation of the breasts or other limbs, and in extreme cases, the complete dissection of the body, is a prerequisite component of the lust murderer profile. What this purpose entails can vary. Dissection of the body committed by the antisocial type usually is done with the aim to conceal the identity of the victim and disrupt its investigation. For the asocial type of lust murderer, dissection can be perceived as their way to explore and better understand the sexual parts of the body. This behavior has been compared to that of an inquisitive child who has discovered a new toy. Sex itself is not a required element, but when there is actual penile penetration, this is typically committed by the antisocial lust murderer, who desires to express his distaste for and complete rejection of normal societal expectations. This can include the act of necrophilia. The asocial lust murderer is more likely to insert foreign objects into the victim in a curiosity-based but still brutal manner. Both types of lust murderers are known to keep trophies of their victims. These most frequently will include an object or piece of clothing, but sometimes they can include something even more intimate and personal, such as a lock of hair, a fingernail, or even a part of the body, which they hold a sexual association with. This is done so that the perpetrator has a piece of the act performed, a physical piece of the memory of the crime they can use to help remember and relive the murder. In the most extreme of crimes, the lust murderer may even consume part of the body, which is known as an anthropophagic act, which literally is defined as man-eater and is almost exclusively resigned to the asocial type. As for the crime scene itself, very little physical evidence will remain behind from the non-social lust murderer, whereas the asocial may leave evidence since the act was committed in a disorganized and chaotic manner. Research shows that both types are likely to return to the scene of the crime. The non-social lust murderer returns to relive the crime, and sometimes even to further mutilate the body if it has not yet been discovered. The asocial lust murderer is driven to return to the crime scene to determine whether or not the body has been found and to keep a watchful eye on the investigation. The non-social is often obsessed with the investigation and will frequently visit places where they may overhear the police discussing the crime. Some offenders may go so far as to become involved in some capacity in the ongoing investigation. Of these cases, the study noted how there was one particular murderer who returned to the crime scene after the initial crime scene investigation had taken place and left articles of the victim's clothing there that were worn the day she had been killed. Who and how one becomes a lust murderer has been a question that psychologists and criminal profilers have attempted to explain. Although the specifics of the individual's upbringing may be too complex and multi-layered and vary from person to person to commit to a set profile, it is generally supported that the origins of such a creation stem from the earliest years of development. Similar to many profiles on serial killers, the lust murderer is highly unlikely to have been brought up in a nurturing, positive, and loving home. Abuse and neglect are expected to have been present in the offender's childhood, as well as high levels of conflict. As a result, this type of individual never developed coping mechanisms in order to properly deal with their problems in a healthy way. The disorganized asocial type would respond to such a toxic environment and society's rejection of them, whether only perceived as such or real, by withdrawing from it. They internalize their rage and hostility towards society, and often suffer greatly from a low self-image. This person would be viewed by society as the quiet, nice guy, who didn't seem to realize much less fulfill his own potential. It is suggested that this type of profile in their youth may engage in behavior aligned with that of a voyeur, such as peeking inside girls' windows or stealing women's clothing. This tends to be a direct reflection of their lack of confidence and ability in real life to interact with girls and women directly. In stark contrast, is the organized non-social who boldly expresses his disgust towards society in aggressive ways. This person would be described as the troublemaker, and manipulator of anyone with whom he has relationships. They commonly have problems and conflicts with family, friends, and especially members of authority. I find it fascinating how Jason Eric Massey ticked off almost all of the boxes of the organized non-social lust murderer. Although he was not part of a respectable family or group in town, and he had an extensive criminal history, he seemed to be well-liked by people, even though he shared some of the most disgusting and vile desires a human can express to others, he still had a steady group of friends and acquaintances. Except for his mullet, he was a good-looking, even innocent-looking kind of guy, with blonde hair and a face reminiscent of a cherub. He had charmed his way into Christina's heart and mind, and her brother James Bryan must have thought he was a cool guy, since he too snuck out of the house that night for them all to hang out together. This all directly points to Jason Massey's ability to effectively manipulate the relationships around him to his favor. In regards to the warning signs of Jason Massey becoming a lust murderer, they were everywhere, but those in his immediate circle, as well as mental health professionals, denied the seriousness of his behavior and his expressed desire to cause harm. In 1991, Jason Massey had been evaluated by a state psychiatrist for some unknown reason, which I would presume because at the time he was still a minor and his records would be sealed. He shared with the psychiatrist how he fantasized about becoming a serial killer and how he had listed names of specific girls he wanted to murder inside his journal. The psychiatrist had Jason Massey committed to a mental hospital, where it is believed he remained there until the middle of 1993. It is not known what kind of mental health therapy or counseling, if any, Jason Massey had during his time there, and there are no records as to why it was decided by his psychiatrist that he was healthy enough to leave. Shortly after he was released, the police pulled Jason over and found a dead cat inside his car. He was arrested for a DUI and sentenced to 120 days in jail. When he was arrested for drug possession in August of the same year, the search warrant revealed several different items which could have been utilized as tools in the murder. These included a three-bladed axe, a hatchet, a large knife, and a claw hammer. The murders of the two innocent youths would only be 51 days after he was released from the mental health center. There were screaming calls to pay attention to the depraved mind and sadistic intentions Jason Massey had in mind for young girls, in particular toward Christina. Maybe his friends did just think he was weird and attempted to shock them when he shared his grotesque fantasies with them, but they all knew he was messed up in the head enough to keep the heads of animals he had murdered inside a cooler. Was it so much of a stretch to believe that what he was sharing with them was what he genuinely intended to do? Why weren't they disturbed enough to mention it to someone else who then maybe would have warned Christina of how dangerous this baby-faced older guy she was so interested in really was? One will never know whether she would have listened to the warnings about him, which could have stopped her and her brother from going out that fateful night in the country. Then again, Jason Massey was inspired to kill and mutilate and had a mission to murder her and violate her corpse, so most likely nothing would have stood in his way. Thankfully, Jason Eric Massey was not bright enough to successfully conceal the crime and was caught before his dreams of becoming a serial killer could come to fruition. If he had been more intelligent and reserved, not shared his revolting desires with others, kept animal heads in a cooler, and written in his journals about his killings of animals and horrific plans of the murder of mass amounts of humans, I have no doubt he could have rivaled the most prolific of serial killers. He had a way with people, and between his face and his personality, he had the potential to manipulate and seduce a lot of young girls and women. I have a tendency to be affirmatively against the death penalty, but in such a case as this, it almost felt like it was necessary. Fortunately, he was never given the opportunity to fulfill his dreams of becoming a serial killer. And instead, Jason Eric Massey will forever be known as the young man with the Slayer's Books of Death, who caused the tragic deaths of two young teens whose shocking murders will forever linger in the town of Tellico, Texas. What do you think of Jason Massey and his horrific crimes? Is there anything or anyone that could have even hypothetically shifted the direction of his dark and twisted path? Or was he perhaps a rare form of human that is born evil? And literally, the only thing that could have stopped him was ending his life. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I'm beyond thrilled to be your host. Until next time, stay safe and watch out for shades of murder in the streets, next door, and especially inside your own home. Alita Dogma Shades of Murder is created, researched, written, and edited by Alita Dogma. Music by Alshot Danilian, courtesy of Pixabay.